hope that our few remaining friends give up on trying to save us. I hope we come up with a fail-safe plot to piss off the dumb few that forgave us. I hope the fences we mended fall down beneath their own weight. And I hope we hang on past the last exit. I hope it's already too late. And I hope the junkyard a few blocks from here someday burns down. And I hope the rising black smoke carries me far away, and I never come back to this town again. In my life, I hope I lie and tell everyone you were a good wife. And I hope you die. I hope we both die.
This is Comics Therapy, episode 21. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, three new books from December 11th, 2013. Superman Wonder Woman number 3, Coffin Hill number 3, and Alex and Ada number 2. As always, we have your nerd confessions, and on the couch, we're very excited to welcome artist Steve Lieber from Periscope Studios. As a reminder, we don't do reviews, but we do talk a lot, and there may be spoilers from here on out.
Fellow caller enters to Comics Therapy, Keith Silva here. Since neither Andrea or Aaron are licensed to respond to anything we call in to say on this show, I thought direct address would be best. Cam, the other Aaron, Mrs. Boyd, the indomitable Mr. Ruth. Hey all, deal breakers, eh, ladies and lady dudes? Let me switch it up here a touch. Let's go with artists first. Number one, you got your Paul Pope. If you don't read Paul Pope comics, deal breaker. I'm an art-first type of dude lady, and rather than rattle off a bunch of artists you should keep close at hand, since art is so idiosyncratic, like everything else, here, let me just push this soapbox over here. That'll do. My deal breaker is I hope the rarest of rare individuals who couldn't give a snick about small breast comics. You can have your images, your ID dubs, and even your black masks. Make mine small press. This is where capital C comics are being made. These are creators like you and me. They have a passion for comics. That's adjective-less comics. There are so many weird and wild and whacked out comics being made by fearless artists who want nothing more than to tell a story using the medium of comics. Simple as that. We live in an amazing age where you can go to any artist or writer's website and buy directly from the artist. Cut out the middleman. Your computer could be your own LCS. The people who make, sell, and promote small press comics love comics as much as you. And the best thing about mini comics and other small press stuff, it's a one-way ticket to cool. Next stop, you. So give Becky Cloonan and Andy Belanger your hard-earned loonies. And don't forget to check out the awesome small presses like Uncivilized Books, 2D Cloud, and Grimalkin Press. Don't thank me. Thank yourselves. And now back to your regularly scheduled program with Isaiah and Chandler. Aaron and Andrea. Whatever. Silva taking down the machine from the inside. Hey, why is it Isaiah and Sharon never answer these questions? They just ask.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. The theme of the show this week is relationships, specifically the toxic kind. We've all had them. Where a little piece of you dies inside every day it continues. Some of us may even be in one currently. It's not always a romantic relationship, mind you. You could have a toxic friend or coworker or podcast co-host.
Ooh, amen.
Problem usually is that it's a lot easier to get over the poison after you've gotten it out of your system. But the path to recovery itself is never fun.
Some of us are just stuck in it weak.
After week.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, celebrating the geeky things we all do, say, read, and enjoy. This week's prompt asked listeners to share their deal breaker comic, the one your significant other must love or else it's Splitsville. You can call, Skype, or email your confessions. All the details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. We're posting the weekly theme on the website, on Twitter, and on Facebook for your convenience, and the rest is up to you.
I take that deal breaker stuff really seriously. I should probably talk to somebody about that.
Yeah.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter at Andrea Schock and Aaron at Aaron Myers. And of course, the show account at Comics Therapy. So Aaron, how was your week in the frozen tundra of Eugene, Oregon?
Yeah, we're not really equipped for heavy snowfall here.
What is heavy snowfall?
8 inches.
Okay, that's legit.
And that's the most we've ever gotten since we've lived here.
Okay.
Usually once a year we'll get 2 or 3 inches, you know, and it'll melt off the next day. But we got a lot of snow and it's been cold, so it hasn't melted, and the roads are pretty dicey still, and the schools have been closed. It's just, you know, even though it's Oregon, we're still at sea level here, and it's just not, we usually get a lot of rain, but we don't get a lot of snow.
Right. So wait, the schools are still closed?
Yeah, because the roads are just not, have not been plowed.
That's bizarre.
And so they're iced over, and, you know, yeah, it took me 45 minutes to get to the comic book store today. I mean, of course, I still went.
How long does it normally take you?
Like 25 minutes.
Okay.
You just have to go really slow. And it's just, people are, you know, we're, like my car doesn't have snow tires on it or anything. I don't have chains.
But you're so dedicated that you cleaned it all off and you headed out into the disastrous snowpocalypse just to get your comics.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
What am I going to do? Not get them?
I don't know. Read them digitally?
No, that's crazy.
Right.
It's insane.
Well, it's more convenient when the weather is, like, working against you.
Yeah, but it's not a new comic book day without going to the comic book store.
My new comic book day started last night at, like, 12:30. I don't know why, but the DC and Vertigo books were available, like, super, super early on Comixology last night.
Is that not normal? I had always heard that DC puts their digital stuff up, like, pretty much the turn of the day.
I guess it's very possible that that's the way it always is. I don't read a whole lot of DC titles. It's kind of absurd, but we actually have 2 books from DC and Vertigo this week. So it was, I guess, if that's the normal way of doing things, I had not ever noticed it before.
Well, now you'll just have to start reading DC.
Just because of that?
Yeah, so you can start at midnight.
Or I could just go to bed earlier and then it would be like, normal.
Right. Well, you know, whatever. So how about you? How much snow did you get in San Francisco?
Ah, there's no snow, but it was definitely a little chilly. It's gotten better, though. It's back to, like, sort of normal 60s during the day and, I guess, 40s during the night.
Mm-hmm.
I still have roses blooming, so I don't know.
Yeah. Got a real tough life, kiddo.
Uh-huh. Every week, dude. Every single week, you have to point out how cushy my life is.
Just saying. Trying to keep it real with you. My roses got frost on them.
Hey,
whatever am I to do?
I didn't fucking plant them. I think I went on record as saying,
of course, you had your gardener plant
stop.
Them. We get it.
That's not true at all. My new house has, like, I don't know, whoever lived here before was not as terrible with flowers as I am. I love flowers. I think they're awesome. I love when people send me flowers. I think they're beautiful. Just don't ask me to maintain them for any length of time.
I will do none of the above.
Right, of course.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, other than that, it's just hard to be snowed into your house with little kids, because especially a 3-year-old wants to go outside, and it was last first couple of days, it was just so cold, you really couldn't go outside for very long.
Right.
And the snow is not like snowman building snow.
Is it it's all like the icy pellet kind?
Yeah, that's, yeah. It's kind of getting to the point now where I could build snowman, because it's melted a little bit. But so, you know, a lot of like the snowtime activities weren't great.
Winter is dumb.
Yeah, you could stay inside and read. I like to do that.
Right, but not when you're 3. You want to go and play outside.
Yeah, well, he'll be old enough soon. He'll want to just sit around, play video games, maybe read comic books.
Like every good American boy.
That's right.
Hey, I saw an awesome movie, speaking of things that are cold and wintry.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. You may have noticed that I talked about it a lot on the internet.
Yeah, you and everyone else.
No, there's just a couple of us. I really don't think there's that much overlap between Frozen, the new Disney animated musical, and, you know, the rest of you who read comic books and listen to the show.
I am telling you right now that we are not using any music from it.
I didn't even ask.
Yes, but I know it's in your mind.
No,
it was already working and it was churning.
It's not. There are so many more thematically appropriate songs that I could push for us. There's really nothing applicable from Frozen.
I let you pick the music this week.
You did. To be fair, I forced you to. I presented it to you as a complete package with the theme and the books and the music, and you basically signed off on it.
Well, every once in a while, I have to throw you a gimme. Uh-huh. Otherwise, you know, you don't feel like you're contributing to the show.
Mm-hmm. Doing all of the work is not enough. I need to feel more validated somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why we're such a good team.
You are just a gem, Aaron Myers. You are.
Thank you. Do you want to talk about comic books?
I suppose.
All right.
Each week, I give Aaron 90 seconds to talk about whatever he wants that we don't have time to discuss more deeply. 90 seconds, one book, one new comic from the past week. Wait, you know, this is stupid. You're going to break the rules and I'm going to continue to let you because I'm a fucking doormat. Okay, so no more. I'm eliminating the timer, but I'm going to give you the topic. You can talk as long as you want. Consider this my personal revenge for grief counseling. Aaron, let's talk about Rover Red Charlie, the first issue of which came out last week.
I really picked one from this week, too.
Nope. I want you to talk about how Rover Red Charlie made you feel.
Okay. when I saw it in the solicitations, I liked the premise of it. No, I didn't like the premise. It was an intriguing premise.
Okay.
But I said that I wasn't going to order it or pick it up because it was dogs during the apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like to see anything with animals being hurt.
Right. You're fine with people getting totally massacred, but...
Yeah, I mean, it has to be done cleverly.
What, the people massacre or the puppies?
No, people.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't really go for just, you know, straight up horror, like murder porn.
Right.
But, you know, I picked up the first few issues of Crossed just to see what it was like. And
speaking of.
Yeah, this isn't the Crossed universe, but it's something similar.
No, it's not. But that, I thought that was a really interesting point that the guys made on Two-Headed Nerd the other day. Because I felt like there was a connection in terms of the type of world. I'm not proposing that it's the same, and obviously I've only read the first volume of Crossed, so I'm not an expert. But I thought that was at least an interesting analogy.
Sure, yeah. I mean, essentially, except for if it was really in Crossed, it wouldn't work because the way like the Crossed world worked, I mean, you lose all inhibitions. Like the dogs would be ripped apart too.
Right.
You know, people and animals and everything aren't safe. But this is more of the people are killing themselves. And the dog, it's happening, it's from the dog's point of view.
Right.
So
how'd you do?
It's fine. There's one bad part, but it's not as, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be.
What was the bad part?
The book, it's just with a dog dying.
Right. How was the, how did it happen?
He gets, like, beat up and smashed and thrown around by a person.
Right.
So it's you know, like that kind of stuff could happen, but it's not quite the same way like it would happen in Crossed. Like it would happen in Crossed, he would have been like torn apart and then, you know, skull raped or something.
Oh God.
That's what happens in that stupid book.
And that's why I don't read it.
Right. So, but we also didn't know that dog very well. Like, you know, with a comic book, as opposed to, like, real life, like, you could see a video of a dog or something, and you instantly can connect with it because it's real.
Mm-hmm.
Characters you have to get to know, whether they're animals or people.
Okay.
So I didn't feel that, it wasn't, you know, that pleasant to read, but we also only known that character for a page.
Do you think it matters because Max was kind of like a dick of a dog? Do you think that felt, I don't know, more... I'm not saying rewarding.
Maybe from the writer's, point of view, like you don't feel that bad for losing him.
Right.
And it's also because dogs, we can't talk to dogs and we can't really know what they're saying. We anthropomorphize them a lot more.
Sure, sure. And you're totally projecting like all of your dog anxiety on these characters.
Yes. So, but these characters still are talking to each other. So they're not just dogs. They're sort of people dogs in that way. So it didn't actually like upset me as much as I thought it was going to.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
You mean like Max dying or the premise completely?
The premise and Max dying.
Got it.
You know, if it was, like, I would say it would be more hard to read if you really didn't even get words from them. It was more just, like, silent panels of them, like, running for their lives and getting out of situations.
Like the pizza dog issue of Hawkeye?
Right, yeah. Where you can kind of get a glimpse into what they're thinking, but mm-hmm. you don't have dialogue.
Yeah, no, I can see that. But I think
that would be a more intense story.
That it's interesting. It would be more intense for you because that would be much more of a not exactly turn off, but it would be. I would feel much less connected that way.
You would?
I would. Yeah, I'm not a dog person at all. I think dogs
really?
Are fine, but
I didn't
in
know
terms
that.
Of you, what?
I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, I have a cat, dude.
Yeah, but you also don't have a life that's really conducive to dogs.
Well, what? I don't know how to respond to that.
Well, you know, with your gardeners and your
No, really. Yeah, like, what? I think that having a dog and having, like, the commitment of taking care of a dog is where I would fall short. I'm terrible at responsibility and, you know.
So, well, that's really what I was saying.
Right. I just was saying it for you so that you
don't
have to feel
cats
bad.
Can kind of take care of themselves.
Right.
So.
Also, they're hilarious. And dogs are messier and smellier and, like, wetter and stuff.
Yeah, like people.
I don't really like people.
Mm-hmm. I don't like people either, but I like our dog people.
Uh-huh. So are you going to keep reading, I guess, is the question, because I remember how you felt about when the solicitations came out. And then I was actually surprised that you had picked this up afterwards and were kind of working through reading it.
Yeah, I think I will pick up the next one and I'll see where it goes. And if it really gets, if it's more just heading towards the horror porn, you know, category.
Mm-hmm.
Won't feel too much of a need to continue with it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was the first issue was interesting enough. It was a lot better than I thought it was going to be. It made me want to read the next one.
Okay.
And I didn't feel also like if it was really well done to the point like what I was talking about, where I was feeling like so tied to the characters that I didn't want to see them hurt, like something like a Walking Dead. Then I wouldn't pick up the next one because I don't want to read it.
Oh, fascinating. So if you get to the point where you learn enough about the characters that you are, like, relating to them, not just projecting onto them, then you will avoid it just in case something bad happens to them?
In a case like this, yeah. I mean, I still read The Walking Dead.
I know, but those are people. These are dogs.
Right. Yep.
Aaron, this is so fascinating.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah, huh. There's like a little tiny shred of heart in there somewhere, I think.
Just for animals.
Right. It's adorable.
Yeah, I'm okay.
I'll let you talk about a comic next week if you're really interested in following the rules. But I just felt like this time you had to be punished for your past indiscretions.
And on a day-to-day basis, when it comes to you, I have almost zero interest in following the rules.
I know.
Do you want to talk about our first book?
Yep.
Okay.
So I'm not sure if it would be considered a comic or a manga. His work seems to ride the line, but my deal-breaker comic is Brian Lee O'Malley's Lost at Sea, truly moving and emotional. It's a painfully human story that I believe transcends the comics platform and is pure art. If it doesn't have an impact on her, then I'd move on.
Our first book this week is Superman Wonder Woman number 3, written by Charles Soule and drawn by Tony S. Daniel, with inks by Bat, colors by Tomu Morey, and lettering by Carlos Mangual. Superman Wonder Woman is published by DC Comics.
Why don't you try saying Superman Wonder Woman 3 times fast?
I can't.
So I kind of love the solicit for this series because it's so bananas. Quote, a bold new series that details the relationship between the Man of Steel and the Warrior Princess. It tells the tale of a romance that will shake the stars themselves. These two super beings love each other, but not everyone shares their joy. Some fear it, some test it, and some will try to kill for it. Some say love is a battlefield, but where Superman and Wonder Woman are concerned, it spells doomsday. So, right, it's basically exactly what it sounds. Superman and Wonder Woman are together, because why the hell not?
Sells books.
Does it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know why, but it does.
It is bananas, though, right? It's just...
Well, it kind of made me think, like, is it bananas, or does it kind of make sense in some, like, in some relationship ways?
Okay.
Because, so there's two different ways to think of, I think, the Superman relationship. like Superman in terms of Lois Lane is a much different, well, it's a much different thing than Superman and Wonder Woman in that Lois Lane can never understand what it's like to be Superman.
Sure.
And Superman can't really understand what it's like to be like a regular person,
right,
or really be Lois. So there's that dichotomy there that's always been interesting for, you know, whatever, 70 years.
Right.
But when you have Superman and Wonder Woman, you have two heroes who understand the pressures of being heroes, but whose powers are come from very different places. It's that whole speech in this thing between Batman and Superman.
Yeah, I thought that was... It was hilarious, but it was actually very insightful about
it works.
Perspectives.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, you have a character that comes from the world of the gods and has never been a person and is trying to learn to be a person. She could potentially learn that from, you know, from Clark. And he can learn what it means to have that responsibility, the weight on his shoulders of being the king of the world, in a way.
Maybe. I don't know. I am aware of the fact that this makes me like a huge hypocrite, even more than usual, because I'm a hopeless romantic. I always want the girl to get the guy. I get swept up when he sweeps her off her feet. And yet with this one, I feel like maybe this is too much of a good thing.
Well, yeah, except for, you know, that it's doomed to never last because of, you know, reasons, quote unquote.
Right. And also because we're talking about a publisher that like basically came out and said two characters won't be getting married, like ostensibly because it would be bad for the story. And so when you pitch a story that's based entirely around the relationship and balancing being a superhero in a relationship, I don't think anybody's making any fucking wedding plans for Diana and Clark. But I know, yeah. I'm the worst kind of hypocrite because like I'm the ambivalent kind, but I don't know how this fits with like the larger picture, like the larger New 52 world, which I'm slowly getting more familiar with. Definitely nowhere near like most of you guys, but when I come across a book like this, I'm like, what? Wait, is this even meant to fit into what I am like relearning about Wonder Woman and Superman?
Yeah, it is. It fits within the Justice League, you know, universe and everything else, just as much as like any kind of like Avengers story or something
and,
would.
You know, Batman hanging out, chatting with Superman on the phone about, they had like a little bro moment there.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, that's all within that Justice League kind of envelope.
Okay.
So it does. And the writing is done well enough to where it's interesting. You know, there's a lot of DC writers that could be writing this that I would just go like, oh, I don't care, you know?
I think that the struggle that like Superman is having because of the like power influx thing is actually what's propelling this into more interesting territory. I have to admit, like those moments with Diana where she's palling around with her girlfriend talking about, oh, I don't know what to buy Clark for Christmas. Like, what? It really reduces her role in the relationship in a weird way when they're trying to balance the power like that. Like, she's not an idiot.
Yeah.
She's never been presented as an idiot. And I just felt like, and continue to feel like those moments, if we're presenting this as a examination of a relatively equal superhero relationship, they are not being presented equally.
I think that's a fair analysis. It's also a problem with the New 52 that, so like Wonder Woman's main, her standalone book,
mm-hmm,
is really outside of any kind of New 52 continuity. Like, okay, the Wonder Woman that Cliff Chang presents is very different and really well done and really gets it. And it has nothing to do with like the Justice League Wonder Woman that's, you know, thinner and more sexy and womanly and demure and, well, she wants to date Superman and she used to date this guy and, you know, that sort of thing. It's a very different focuses. I wish this was more, it wouldn't work with the, like, Cliff Chang's Wonder Woman. Like, she would never date Clark Kent. It's totally ridiculous. So they're two different characters completely.
That's so bizarre. I'm only, I guess, about a third of the way into the second volume of the, like, of Wonder Woman from the New 52. Mm-hmm. So be that as it may, it just seems wacky that then we actually have two different representations of the same character. I mean, we're not talking two different universes at this point, are we?
Nope.
We're just talking about two different, dramatically different interpretations of the same character that are supposed to coexist.
Yep.
So just again, as a newer reader, that's like a huge barrier for me.
That is a big reason why I don't read a lot of DC.
Right. But so anyway.
But people could argue the same thing about Hawkeye, that Fraction's Hawkeye is not Avengers Hawkeye.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. And the moments where Hawkeye acts like Fraction's Hawkeye are, well, like in Inhumanity, which Fraction mm-hmm. wrote.
Right, so he gets to.
Right. Now, that's fair. That's a totally reasonable comparison. And I can also see that somebody coming into it and reading one and not the other would feel just as...
Yeah, it's just I think it's not a DC problem. I just accept it more with Marvel sure. than I do DC. It's just, it's part of the pitfalls of a large shared universe.
Absolutely. And when you have multiple writers involved and multiple storylines and... Like, I'm cool with that. There's going to be inconsistencies, and it doesn't always have to be about continuity. It really doesn't. But I think that the barrier for me with this pairing is that it seems so doomed to failure as to be like a very kind of masturbatory exercise in like, what would happen if, oh, okay, this should be really interesting for like, what, 6 issues, and then it's kind of dumb because it's not sustainable.
Yeah, well, that might be the case. I mean, maybe it's fitting that the first villain they face is Doomsday.
Sure.
It's a metaphor.
It is. I like metaphors.
For their relationship.
I do.
Well, you want to talk about doomed relationships. Do you want to talk about our next book?
Yes, absolutely.
Sleeper by Brubaker and Phillips. Seriously, the power Carver is given, the origin story device for each character, the deep, deep cover plot, and the best female character ever, Miss Misery. If my girlfriend didn't like comics and didn't enjoy Sleeper, that'd be cool. But since she does like comics, if she turned up her nose at that one, we might have had to have a little talk. By the way, you guys make an awesome show. Keep on keeping on.
Our second book is Coffin Hill number 3, written by Caitlin Kittredge and art by Inaki Miranda, coloring by Eva De La Cruz, and lettering by Travis Lanham. Why do you make me read these?
Because it's really entertaining.
With a cover by Dave Johnson. I can say that. And it's published by Vertigo Comics.
If you are the one messing it up, then it's not me messing it up, so.
Oh, man.
So Eve was your typical spoiled brat New England kid, born with a silver spoon in her mouth and a direct link to witchcraft in her lineage. She dabbled in the dark arts as a rebellious teenager, except shit got real and people died, right? I think that's what happened, or at least got taken by the dark, which is just as bad or worse in my book. 10 years later, she's a cop in Boston and pretty much single-handedly took down the most notorious serial killer the city had seen in years. But then she got shot and she leaves the force, returning to Coffin Hill and her family's estate. Her ex-boy toy, Nate, is a cop in that town, and he catches her snooping around the house. She convinces him that the two missing kids that he's looking for in the woods may have something to do with the crazy stuff from a decade ago that she kind of sort of unleashed on the town.
So there's lots of relationships in this book.
Oh, yeah. It's so fucked up. It's kind of delightful.
See, it's funny because this book doesn't, like, the premise and stories aren't the kind of things that normally would appeal to me.
Right.
And I've been enjoying it, but it's not the kind of thing I gravitate to because it's so relationship focused.
Sure.
But I would like to hear why you're enjoying it so much.
I don't know. I think it's a little bit like Candy. It's not...
It's very old school Vertigo.
It is. Maybe... Nah, I can't necessarily say that that's what is appealing. I mean, I enjoyed older Vertigo titles. Didn't everybody. But but that's not... I didn't pick it up and make that connection. I think that there's something like inherently young adult paranormal romance about this, and I'm all about that. It's just like an easy escape from other either real life things or even other books or comics that require like a little higher level thinking. And I don't mean that this is not a sophisticated story, and I don't mean that there's not a lot of things going on here. I think it's relatively familiar, and sometimes that's fun. And it's familiar in a way that is pretty to look at. And yeah, I dig it. And I think that the interesting banter with Eve and Nate especially is dime a dozen, but it's a particular dozen that I think you don't actually see very often in comics as a medium.
Yeah, that's fair. I'll say I don't want to make it sound like I don't like this. I think it's taken me 3 issues to like it.
Okay.
I didn't, you know, the first one, I was like, eh, okay, fine. Second one, I'm like, all right, I kind of, you know, I see some of this developing. Now, in this third one, I'm like, okay, I get these relationships more. It doesn't feel like work to connect the dots. Mm-hmm. And I want to make it clear, too, that it's not like the story, like the art, it doesn't work or the writing isn't good, because it really is. It's the kind of person I am and the kind of stories that I read.
I don't think that you're necessarily the intended audience for this book.
I think that's fair, but at the same time, after 3 issues, like this third issue, I started to enjoy it and not feel like I was reading it as, you know, material for the show or something.
Right. That's good.
So that, you know, it's also kind of why, like, people ask, like, why are you sticking with a book you didn't like, you know, the first issues of? Because I think the answer is sometimes stories need time to mature.
They do, and they broaden. So I think that the focus now is on what happened 10 years ago in Coffin Hill and what's happening now and how those two things are linked. And we've got more than one mystery going on. And then I actually think that the, like, unpacking what actually happened with Eve and Nate then and what's happening with them now is actually a sort of nice bookend to, like, the more kind of horror-focused part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess seeing Eve's response to trauma and then, like, the way that she kind of lashes out as a result is also, I don't know, it doesn't really bode well for anything real and, like, stable happening between her and Nate. And I think that her response after she, like, she spends the night with him, and what does her note say? Like,
I'm
not sorry. That's awesome. She's such a badass in a way that is, again, like, very familiar and, like, almost predictable, but is still endearing.
Well, this has got to appeal to you because, I mean, you grew up privileged in a small town, right? So,
Aaron.
Oh.
Try again.
I'm
not
kidding.
Not from New England. Didn't grow up privileged, didn't grow up in a small town. Also,
you are a witch.
Not a witch. Never dressed like her. Wow. Her her little ensemble when she crashes the chandelier is.
Is that like, that's like 90s punk, though.
It is, but it's, remember a couple weeks ago when we were talking about like goth princess bullshit?
Yes.
That's more like the world that I associate with that. And it's...
Yeah, right.
It's also 2003, I think. Yeah, because it's 10 years.
Okay. Yeah, so I guess time goes by.
It's later than when I was in whatever phase we're going to talk about happened in high school.
I saw those pictures. I would say you were grunge. It's flannel and Doc Martens. That is the grunge look.
When did you see pictures of me in flannel and Doc Martens?
You put up a couple.
I had a dress on. There was no flannel.
Yeah, it looked like flannel.
It was a dress. What the fuck?
I am no fashion expert, but that's flannel.
That's not fashion, dear. That's like basic form over function.
So anyway, I think part of why this is hard for me to read sometimes is because I hate to have to think about like that going back home kind of thing, like that journey back home.
Got it. Okay.
To where it's like, oh, you see the people from high school and, you know, all the familiar faces that are now are like 10 years older and you don't live there anymore. So it's like, agreed, it's familiar and unfamiliar at the same time.
That's more depth than I was giving it, but you're absolutely right.
There's just a supernatural aspect to it and a much heavier,
right,
you know, weight associated in this story, but it's still essentially a lot of that same sort of thing.
Right. Right, you can never go home again. No, that's true. And plus, like, everybody's relationships in high school were, like, toxic and terrible, even mm-hmm. without the dark and, you know, demons and shit involved.
Right.
Nobody actually ends up happy with their high school sweetheart, except my brother and sister-in-law.
But for how long?
Like, always. It's adorable.
Well, good for them. Let's talk about our next book.
What the hell? I'm just saying, it does happen, except for all those other times it doesn't.
Right. Well, the exception proves the rule.
Yeah. Last book?
Last book.
Greetings, comic therapists. This is Roderick Ruth here, at Roderick Ruth on the Twitters, and my deal-breaker comic book for this week's Nerd Confession goes to Runaways by Brian K. Vaughan and Adrian Alfona. This series was superbly written and drawn. Not only guest stars some of the coolest teen superheroes from all around the Marvel Universe, like Cloak and Dagger and Darkhawk, but it also reinvigorated Marvel with some original storytelling as it, you know, operated under the radar and on the fringe of Marvel canon. It's cute, it's dark, it's funny, it's cool. My runner-up deal breaker goes to Preacher. If you can't enjoy or endure the content from this story, we're done. Finito. We probably have nothing in common and I probably hate you already. Anyway, thanks Aaron and Andrea. Peace.
Our final book is Alex and Ada, number 2, published by Image Comics. Alex and Ada is written by Sarah Vaughan and Jonathan Luna, with art, lettering, and design by Jonathan Luna.
Poor Alex. In the not-too-distant future, our lives are automated for our convenience, our very thoughts the means to control the technology embedded in our homes and jobs, available at whim. But Alex is super lonely. He's broken up with Claire 7 months ago, or rather, it seems she's left him, and he's rather despondent still. He doesn't do so well with fellow human interaction, in fact. For his birthday, his grandmother sends him a top-of-the-line android companion to try to alleviate his emotional stupor.
Man, we are so lucky this doesn't exist, and by we, I mean me.
Oh, okay, super creepy. Tell me more.
Oh my god, are you kidding me? If we could buy android companions like this, I probably never would have dated.
Aaron, that's possibly the most disturbing thing you've ever said.
No, I'm keeping it real. And I think that's true for a lot of people.
I don't know. I get loneliness, okay? And I totally understand and can relate, and it sucks. But at the same time, like a facsimile of a relationship isn't the same thing.
Maybe it's better.
But, okay. I mean, I guess if you're not trying it, you don't know for sure, but it, I don't know. I think that Alex is so, like, wrapped up in woe that...
I agree. I mean, I'm kind of a third kidding. I think it's very easy.
Well, third.
I think it'd be... Because relationships are difficult.
Sure.
And tiring, and it would be very nice to have a companion that was sort of programmed for your compatibility.
Yes.
But that's different than a companion who's programmed to serve you. Does that make sense?
Guess.
What if you had a fake companion whose programming was designed not to, like, be like a sex slave or like a house slave or something like that?
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, of course not. But that would learn you and adapt their personality patterns to best meet, you know, your needs.
Dude, there is not an algorithm in the world that could figure out what I need.
If well,
I
they would can't... also make sure your medication levels were correct. And
dick. I don't know. It's still not the same. It's not real.
I think you're idealizing things too much.
I obviously idealize everything. I mean, I just said that before. I'm 100% about being a princess one day. Like, bring it on. I think that kind of shit is awesome. And for a long time, I struggled with it because that's not what you're supposed to want, being all, like, liberal and feminist and all of that. But who cares? Sometimes it's really nice to be taken care of and treated in that kind of way. I don't think that knowing that I was being treated like a princess by somebody or something programmed to do that would be the same at all. Like, you would always know.
Sure, but at the same time, you're then what's the standard? Like, what's the standard for a partner?
Well, I think that you can't hold people to an ideal standard, and I'm not proposing that. What I'm saying is that there's a baseline that you can expect from, like, your fellow humans, that you can surround yourself with people who you have high expectations for and who meet those expectations, and it's mutually beneficial. And that is a very important way to function in society.
In current society, because we don't have android sex slaves.
But when you throw in android sex slaves into the mix, then that imbalance between the ideal and the real just gets so out of whack, and you can't hold one side to the standard of the other.
I don't know. I think in some respects we have that already in a lot of relationships. I mean, even with friends, you know, like when you have an online relationship with someone, it's an idealized relationship.
Sure.
Because they have time to respond. You know, they have time to present the person that they want you to see.
Absolutely.
And it's not the same person they're going to be face-to-face or living, you know, living with someone.
Right.
So, you know, society's already skewed in a lot of ways like that.
Right. I actually find that, like, super fascinating, just because it has been such a rapid transition over the past several years, especially with Twitter, like, way more than, like, chat rooms and IRC from the past. I think that it's a much more, like, global transition. And that's kind of awesome and kind of scary. But we're still not talking about what happens when you have a physical manifestation of that. And in the case of Alex and Ada, he's, in this issue especially, he's given the chance to, and like goes through the motions of sending her back and then like decides not to. Like, that's almost giving up. That's almost realizing or recognizing that there's not going to be anybody else out there. And that's like the opposite of romantic. That's just fucking resigned and super sad.
I think romance is idealizing the relationship algorithm, though.
Well, the fact that you're talking about relationships and algorithms together automatically sets you and I apart.
Sure. I mean, I try not to think about the actual aspects of, say, love and marriage, companionship, family. But there's biological drives for all of this.
Okay.
You know? And it's not something you think about because it doesn't make any sense to. But, you know, there's a reason you would pick a mate. You would have children with that mate. And, you know, you would want your children to grow up and continue a lineage. I mean, these are all biological drives.
Sure.
But we've chosen to write romance stories around them. And there's magic. And it's, you know, it's the fates coming together. No, it's pheromones, biology, you know, sexual compatibility and genetic reproduction.
Okay. I don't disagree with any of that. And please know that as much as, like, I find the story part of the, you know, even the concept of romance appealing, like, I'm a relatively down-to-earth girl when it comes to the reality of it.
But who wants to live in the reality? I'm the same way. I like a happy ending story with people falling in love. I'm the first one to cry about it. But the reality is, you know, that's not really what happens. But that's the difference between story and reality.
Sure. But I think that that's one of the reasons why I find this story to be really sad. Like, I find Alex's resignation and, like, withdrawing from the algorithm, as it were, to be, like, a sign of defeat. And I think it's interesting just because I think, like, the future world that is created here is, like, super compelling and very much something that I think is, like, on the horizon. And so it's very believable. But the, like, the decision that he makes, even though I'm interested in seeing how his relationship with Ada develops, like, at the core, kind of bums me out a little bit.
I don't know. I see these first two issues being setting up the rehab, the relationship rehab he needs. He's not ready to send her back because he doesn't know how to walk yet. He needs a prosthetic to help him learn to walk again.
Okay. Again with the really solid metaphors, Myers. Good job.
Well, I get into stories about sex slaves. Only android ones.
Right. Yes. You're an equal opportunity sex slave fan. I get it.
Sure.
Get it.
So anyway, it's early in this series, but I'm very hooked on it. And it is a very simple story, and it's so compelling too.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a reason for that, because we find this whole idea of what makes relationships real, where technology is heading, and that kind of convergence of technology, the synthetic and the physical.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is something everybody should pick up, and I don't know, maybe we'll revisit it when it's over.
Yeah, I'm still rooting for Alex to find like a real girl.
We'll see. Well, do you want to talk to a real man?
I don't know about that transition. Not sure how I feel about it, but...
Look, they're not always going to be good.
No, they're really not. But yes, in fact, we had a really fantastic conversation with Steve Lieber from Periscope Studio, and you should absolutely check out their Kickstarter for Maiden Voyage, the art book series that they are putting out. I think there are about 7 days remaining on that Kickstarter, so give it a listen and check it out online.
My deal breaker would have to be Blankets by Craig Thompson. It transcends genre and medium, and it means a lot to me personally. My wife doesn't read comics, but she was willing to read it for me. She thought it was pretty good. I'll take it. Josh Knight Nurse Cruz at Josh Cruz Really. Thanks. Bye.
We're very excited to welcome Steve Lieber to the couch this week. Steve is an artist and a founding member of Periscope Studio, the largest studio of freelance comic book illustrators and storyboard artists in North America. He's currently drawing Superior Foes of Spider-Man for Marvel Comics and was nominated for an Eisner for his limited series Whiteout, written by Greg Rucka, the sequel to which won an Eisner for Best Limited Series in 2000. I've been looking forward to talking with Steve for a while now, but we especially wanted to have him on the show to talk about Periscope Studios' upcoming art book publication, Maiden Voyage. Thanks so much for making time for us, Steve.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And you're from Pittsburgh. High five.
Yes. Oh, are you as well?
Yeah.
Very neat. I grew up in Squirrel Hill.
So I grew up in the East End, and I went to Carnegie Mellon. So
I spent most of my Sunday afternoons just walking around the CMU campus. It was great.
Yep, good place. Absolutely. Did you go to Alderdice?
Yes.
Okay.
Graduated in 1985, diploma and everything.
Good job. You went there and you completed your schooling there.
Yes.
Do you go back home at all?
Not since my parents both died. So 2004 was the last time I was there. I think I visit there mostly by listening to interviews with Ed Pisker.
Awesome.
Well, you're in Portland now, though.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same with the rest of the Periscope Studio folks. It kind of makes it feel like an entirety of the West Coast comics creators kind of work there in Portland these days. Can you tell us a little bit about Periscope's history and how it's grown over the years?
Sure. There had been a comic studio in Portland before Periscope that kind of fell apart over some interpersonal conflicts, as these things sometimes do.
Mm-hmm.
And for a couple of years, the main social interaction between cartoonists was just getting together for coffee and super informal drink and draws, a lot of coffee mainly, because that's what you do in the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
And over time, people started to realize that it was great being around other artists and sharing business gossip and letting off steam and showing, doing show and tells. Of, here's what I'm working on. And ooh, I like this. This is cool. Let me show you what I'm working on. And so folks decided to look into forming another studio. There's a flurry of emails back and forth as people threw ideas at each other. Who would be a good fit for this? What part of town should we be thinking about? The way things tend to flow with this kind of stuff is all power flows to the volunteers. So the people who were willing to actually walk around calling real estate agents were the ones who got to pick where we wound up setting up a studio. And by early 2002, it all came together. We were in a space. Originally, there were, I think, 11 of us. And A few folks dropped out almost immediately when they realized that they weren't going to be around. And the rest formed a really, really tight core. And over time, we moved into a new space and started bringing in other folks. Some folks moved to town. Drew Johnson moved to Portland for a while and became part of the studio. Jeff Parker moved to Portland and immediately was part of our collective. And eventually just sort of the gravitational pull of all these cartoonists working in a space started pulling in other cartoonists. And the culture has changed a lot. It was originally 10 guys and one lady. And now it's getting close to 50-50 male and female. Originally, almost everybody was mainstream comics. Now there's a wide variety of engagements with the forum. It's really turned into something.
Yeah, it's amazing the list of people that are there now, and it seems to kind of grow every year with talent and people you have interning who then become, you know, names of their own. It's really been impressive and kind of a lot of fun, you know, from the outside to as a fan to see the talent and the art that's kind of coming out of that space.
Yeah. As far as growing much further, I don't know how much bigger we're going to be able to get. Probably not much at all, because we've kind of run up against the walls of the space. The only way we could take in more people would be if it would be to restrict them to coming in after hours or something.
Start a second shift.
Basically hot bunking like in a submarine.
That's a way to do it. Make it approach it like a way to get the creative juices flowing, you know?
Absolutely. And it would continue the whole submarine metaphor.
Right. What kind of things did you like to draw when you were a kid?
It's funny. I was the kind of kid who just copied other artists as a kid. I had a crappy, unhappy childhood, just sum it up that way. So I wasn't one of those artists who used drawing as a way of engaging with the world around them, who wanted to draw the real world that existed around them as a way of comprehending it and as a way of appreciating it. For me, you know, art and comics was all about escape and about being somewhere that wasn't my childhood. Mm. So I drew pictures of the fantasy worlds that I was trying to live in. So it was a lot of other people's characters. It was a lot of very derivative characters I was making up myself. I don't think I became interested in drawing the real world around me until I was in my late teens and I started to realize that existed too. And that was actually more interesting than the fantasy worlds I was engaging with.
Is that about the time that you decided that, like, art was it? This is what I want to do, and comics specifically is the type or the style of art that I need to do?
I think so. It was sort of a simultaneous thing. Part of it was realizing that if I wanted to tell stories in comics, I needed to learn how to really draw, not just to copy.
Right.
And part of it was opening up to the possibility that the world that wasn't inside my head might be kind of interesting. It might be worth living in too.
Was that just part of growing up, or was there something that changed in life to where it's like you could kind of escape out of the fantasy world?
I started getting things in my life that were worth engaging with and worth living for.
Uh-huh.
Once I got out of the crappy, lousy part of my childhood, I got a job at a game store that I loved and that I was good at.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that I could talk to people well about games and I was good with money. I was responsible, and I started to feel like, this isn't something I want to escape from. This is something worth being in the middle of. And I think that was kind of the core of it right there.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to childhood for a second.
Sure.
It's
comics therapy for a reason.
Right, exactly, yeah. Well, so, you know, to escape, you found comics. I'm guessing, I don't know if it's a linear evolution, but comics were a part of that escape. And
absolutely.
So what did you escape most into? What did you find? What was the entry point, and what did you find yourself gravitating to the most?
This is a weird thing. I read all sorts of comics, and there was no one thing that I plowed into. I mean, I read a lot of superhero comics, and that was probably the core of what I read.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no one character or one publisher or anything like that, because I didn't have a lot of money when I was a kid, nor did my family. And I was not allowed to buy new comics. The only places I could get comics were flea markets. And have you ever heard of stripped books?
Is that, yeah.
Yeah, like where they tore the covers off?
Exactly. There, in the neighborhood across the bridge from me, Homestead, Andrea will might recognize the name.
I used to teach in Homestead.
There you go. there were a couple of stores that sold nothing but stripped books. It was all stuff that was supposed to have been destroyed, but somehow a couple of boxes of things would fall off the truck and wind up in these shops. Hmm. And I could buy 12 coverless comic books for a dollar. But you had, it was just whatever, you got whatever didn't sell. And there was no rhyme or reason to what was available. So it might be Richie Rich, it might be a Marvel comic, it might be some old Charlton thing. And I never got two issues in a row. Mm-hmm. So I was always getting the first half of some two-part with a devastating cliffhanger that I would never, ever get the ending to. Uh-huh. So yeah, my engagement with comics was just get as many comics as possible. And I think I spent a lot of time trying to make up endings because I knew I would never get to read them.
Yeah.
There was one shop in Pittsburgh, Ides Comics, which was a very, very early direct market shop.
Yeah.
But that was three bus rides away from where I was, and it just didn't, and I didn't have the money to buy stuff there anyhow. So the idea of actually getting to pick the comics, to pick exactly the comic you wanted, it wasn't even on my radar.
Hmm. I did read one of your blog posts for the San Diego Comic-Con, and it was kind of, you were talking about some of the 50s EC horror collections you would get at the library.
Yeah, there was just one collection. The thing was about the size of one of those, at least I remember it being this, so I haven't seen it. It may have been smaller. Uh-huh. But I remember it being the size of those giant original art facsimile books that IDW is putting out now.
Yeah.
Mm. Just a huge, huge thing. And it reproduced a whole bunch of old DC comics in vivid, vivid four-color glory.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said in that essay, it took a whole song and dance just to get my hands on it. It wasn't a circulating book. It was part of their permanent reference collection. I would have to take two buses to get to where this library was.
Was it the Carnegie or?
Yeah, in Oakland, yeah.
Yeah.
And I would fill out a request form on a piece of paper, submit it to a basket, go into a waiting area, and then some elderly page would bring it down the hallway in a trundling cart, echoing. It was like the Crypt Keeper was bringing the book to me.
You're really setting the mood, yeah.
Oh, it was spectacular. Then I would spend the entire day just looking at this thing, studying it like Talmud.
Uh-huh.
It was incredible. It was devastating, and I was seeing all these. You know, it was some of the finest work done in those sorts of comics to that point. It was like I was studying the Dead Sea Scrolls. There was nothing like this, and I'd pore over them, and I'd fascinated by the differences in styles. And at that size, you could see every bit of spittle that Graham Ingalls was drawing, mm-hmm. and every bit of lush OCD detail that Wallace Wood was covering his backgrounds with.
And that's all the pre-Comics Code stuff too, right?
So absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So you're really getting some pretty intense things, especially for a young kid.
Oh yeah, the Jack Davis horror story where the ball team murders the member of the other team, mm-hmm. and plays a game with his dismembered body parts. Yeah, juvenile PTSD right there. Oh, for years.
Well, talking about juvenile PTSD, let's talk about Superior Foes of Spider-Man.
That's a beautiful transition. Proud to get to the end of it.
Well, we talked about it back in episode 3, and it's definitely a highlight of our week whenever it's out. Can you talk a little bit about the process working with Nick on that book, and kind of specifically in regards to the visual humor on the page, like what you have to bring to it, basically?
Sure. Nick writes me he gives me remarkable trust as an artist, and that's a real gift for a writer to do. Mm-hmm. Doesn't try to micromanage it at all. Some pages he'll write, the script will be pages 5 through 7, and he'll just give me 15, 20, 30 exchanges of dialogue with no visual information whatsoever.
Oh, wow.
Because he trusts me to know what to do with it. You know, he'll tell me where the scene is set, and if there's a specific gag he has in mind, he might specify it. But you know, he leaves the breakdown and what needs to, and a lot of the visual elements entirely up to me, and that's wow. fantastic. Other times he'll write really, really old-fashioned Marvel style, by which he'll give me a paragraph or two to say what happens on these next three pages with no dialogue.
Mm-hmm. And then he goes back and fills it in?
Yeah, it could be as simple as Luke and Danny bust into the basement, the foes lose badly, here are two things that should happen in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I take it from there, and it's wonderful. There's a lot of writer in how I approach drawing comics. There's a lot of writer in me.
Yeah.
And this is giving me the chance to indulge that.
Well, not only writer though, it's the humor aspect of it seems, you know, it's different than what I'm used to seeing from you and your work, and it's working so well. I kind of wonder, it's like, is this something you had been hoping to do for a long time, like getting to kind of explore this side of creation?
I've been complaining for years that my art is where humor goes to die. this book has kind of been my Leslie Nielsen moment, where I, you know, mm-hmm. I, after 20 years of doing...
This is your airplane, is what you're saying?
Yes, exactly. You know, 20 years of doing deadpan police drama, I get to actually be funny doing the exact same thing.
Yeah.
I've wanted to be funny in comics for a long time. I just didn't have a visual language to do it or material that called for it.
Uh-huh.
With this, everything clicked. In the first script excerpt that I got from issue one, there was a lot of fourth wall breaking in the script, in the way that Nick was writing Boomerang's dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognized that I could play with that and do visual equivalents of that.
Yeah.
There's with an unreliable narrator, there's all sorts of opportunities for interesting things that may not have actually happened in the journalistically reported Marvel universe that people are used to.
Right.
But that I can make perfect, that can make perfect sense in this book.
Right.
I realized very quickly that whereas a lot of books should be read as journalism about the Marvel Universe and you know, an objective report of what happened in Spider-Man's New York City, our book is more like Boomerang, drunk and half in the bag,
right,
across the table from you at a bar, spinning out a story. He's probably getting some facts wrong. He's lying to make himself look better.
Absolutely.
But it's a really entertaining story, and you know, you're not going to walk away when Joe Pesci in Goodfellas is telling you something funny, and you're not going to walk away when Boomerang is either.
That's a great analogy.
As for how it's done, as for getting it across, the process I've evolved is this: first, tons and tons of tiny little thumbnails. I have a basic grid that I designed the book on, which is the 16-panel Dark Knight grid, for lack of a better way to describe it. It's divided to four. Every page is built on a grid that's divided into four rows and four columns, and that means that I've got a lot of little beats to control the timing of jokes. I break down the rhythm of it, and then I start looking for funny, looking for opportunities to insert more funny when it's appropriate. I finally learned the meaning of kill your darlings on this book, because there've been lots of places where I've come up with something that just killed me. That just cracked me up thinking about it, but it didn't work with the rhythm of a page and I had to get rid of it. And that I finally know what it means to lose that stuff. But yeah, and after I've broken things down, sometimes I'll ask the room, hey, I've got a room full of really, really funny people that I can consult with.
Mm-hmm.
Every cartoonist who's trying to do humor should sit within 5 feet of Jeff Parker and Colleen Hoover, because they're brilliant at this stuff. One of our best gags, the one where Boomerang fantasizes about murdering his lawyer.
Right.
That was awesome.
I adored that gag. It came out of nowhere. I was the script just said that Boomerang takes a beat and then answers his lawyer, and I realized that I could do a lot with that beat. But it was Colleen's suggestion to put his floating head right in the center of the panel, and that totally made it.
That's awesome. It's a wonderful visual for my next question of the way that you you're working obviously independently, but you have access to peer review kind of informally constantly. You have this shared workspace with Periscope Studio. So you have multiple artists working collaboratively by osmosis.
Yeah.
So in my own background, having a shared studio space is an awesome resource because you can learn from fellow artists, especially if they have varied or greater experience. So how important is that to the essence of Periscope? I assume that everybody else kind of takes advantage of that resource, just like you described.
To lesser extents, yeah.
Good. It's a very individual thing, right? So how does that setup lead into success for the mentorship program specifically?
Wow. I don't feel like I'm the person who gets to say whether the mentorship program is a success. That'd be up to the protégés, the manatees, the interns and externs.
I can say cursorily, as an informal poll of asking some of the people that have interned and are working there, nobody I've ever talked to has said it was a bad experience. They only have raving reviews and how happy they are to work there.
That's wonderful to hear. Yeah, I hesitate to speak for them, and certainly it's one of those things where I would never entirely trust anything good that they say directly to me, just because. Yeah, I'm an authority figure. Yeah, you can't ask the teacher what the students thought of the class.
Right.
Well, then let's step back and let's approach it more from a teaching perspective, because it is a unique setup. There are not a lot of other opportunities to have a mass of talent and then a system to encourage new talent like you guys can take advantage of it at Periscope.
Mm-hmm. We're building something that we all wanted for ourselves. I went to the Kubert School, so I had exposure to my peers, to a really solid peer group that was very intense about learning the stuff. And I also had access to teachers for limited windows, you know, in the classroom and, 5 minutes of consulting after the class here and there.
Right.
But the idea of being able to just dive in and see how it's done was something that I craved when I got out of school.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get out of art school and presumably you've taken some classes, you've accumulated resources as an artist, but then you have to figure out how to actually support yourself doing this and how to structure an 8-hour day of doing nothing but drawing. Sometimes you've got assignments and you don't know how to handle them. You get contracts, you're not sure how to answer them, or how to deal with them. You're just floating and terrified and have no clue how to go from being someone who's entirely reactive to someone who's proactively creating a business, which is what a commercial artist does. And 3 months of being around people who do it all day is a really, really good way to actually see how it works in real time, to see real problems that artists are running into. Someone gets a script that doesn't make any sense, and what are the best ways to deal with that? Because it's not just artistic problems. There's political problems with an artist dealing with a bad script.
Mm-hmm.
You get a contract back from a publisher, and it doesn't say what you remember being agreed to in the verbal discussions about this stuff. Mm-hmm. How do you handle that? Is a real basic thing. Is it right to use photos? What sort of photos do you use in producing comics, and how do you use them? And I try to make sure that our protégés get exposed to all this stuff and see how we do it and see that there's different answers to it. Colleen Coover probably has shot one piece of photo reference in a decade.
Mm-hmm.
I shoot multiple shots for every single panel I draw in Superior Foes. In fact, a lot of the credit for the acting in some of the dialogue scenes should go to Ben Dewey, Lucy Bellwood, and Paul Guinan, who are brilliant comedic actors for me in still shots.
Mm-hmm.
Dustin Weaver is able to do spectacular realism with barely any photo reference. You know, he'll find reference for how things are constructed or what the details of a building in San Francisco are if he's drawing a scene set in San Francisco, but he would never draw from the angle of the photo. He just wants to know what does the window sash look like on this style of building from this particular year.
Mm-hmm. So your interns have this room of varied experience and various approaches to these problems, and that's incredible. It's just so invaluable to have that at their disposal.
Yeah, and it's a wide variety of views. I mean, the age of our members goes from, I think our youngest is 25, and Natalie Nurrigan I think is 24, 25, mm-hmm. and our oldest, Ron Randall's is in his 50s. I think Carl Kiesel is in his 50s. Yeah. Jeff Parker and David Hahn and I are in our 40s. So they're getting the best of two generations of cartoonists there and everything in between. Somewhere in the room, there's somebody who has faced and solved the problem that they are trying to solve.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about Maiden Voyage. It's a very ambitious campaign for Periscope Studio. Aaron and I are both backing it. We think it's awesome. What's this particular project all about? And what's the long-term plan for publishing art books from other members of the studio?
Well, I think the genesis of it is that our members are ridiculously productive. In addition to turning out comic after comic after comic, they're also doing a whole lot of personal art and illustration and stuff for themselves, stuff for small publishers, illustration things, posters, just an awful lot of art that our comics readers never get to see unless they're carefully monitoring our Tumblrs or our Twitter accounts. And we wanted to put some of that stuff out there for folks to see. And we wanted to do it under the Periscope umbrella because I think one of the strengths of Periscope as an organization is that we've got such a wide variety of talents. So upon lots of discussion and email flurries within the group, we decided to do a series of Periscope art books, each one being the art of a different member. Now there's 25 current members. So we didn't want to put out 25 books at once. That would be ludicrous.
That would be an ambitious Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a publishing house right there. So we decided to do six at a time. With six books, we can show a really diverse slice of what we're capable of without going too far and breaking us and destroying the poor folks from going to have to design these things. And that's where Maiden Voyage came from. We decided to do it as a Kickstarter because publishing six full color books is an ambitious thing, and I'm dying to see the books. You know, I've seen a lot of the design and a lot of the work that's going into it, but frankly, with 25 studio mates, there's a lot of work in there that I haven't seen, and these are people who I sit 10-15 feet from.
Mm. Yeah, is it all self-initiated in terms of choosing the work that's in each of the artists' books?
Yeah, each of the artists curated their own material to be representative of what they're doing when they're not doing comics.
Yeah, it's really fun. I mean, just for example, like just watching like Ron Randall's Facebook page and Twitter feed, and like how excited he is to pull things like out of the past that he worked on that people haven't seen, and things that he's worked on that just never really saw the light of day. It's things that he worked on for himself, or just amazing pieces, you know. And somebody like him who has such a long kind of history of in so much work, it's just exciting to see this kind of stuff come together and have such a varied group of people like in art to bring to the public.
Oh, absolutely. The book that I'm really eager to own amongst all of them, Natalie Nurrigan's, mm-hmm. she's just been a fascinating artist to watch. She initially was an intern with Periscope. She was already remarkably accomplished when she first approached us with her mini comic and just wanted to introduce herself. But she's gone from a really talented amateur with a...
Well, I bought my daughter before she went to... She goes to U of O. So before she started to go there, I bought her Between Gears and gave that to her as kind of here's what to expect about life at the University of Oregon. And it was, you know, kind of a great introductory to life here. She's not from Eugene. You know, we live here in Eugene, but she was relatively new to the area and new to the university, and just such a great, talented book about life of a young college student.
Oh, yeah. Sensitive, a great eye for observation. And even at the start, a wonderful feel for how comics work, for how the rhythm of juxtaposed images on the page plays out.
Mm-hmm.
And then Natalie has developed magnificently as a cartoonist to the point now where she's a world killer and can do so in several different styles. She's just been assimilating influences like crazy and filtering it through a sharp, perceptive eye for both what things look like and how people behave. And you know, she's developed wicked comedy chops. She can do it all, and she's still incredibly young. I want to kill her.
No, it's just awesome to hear you talk about how enthusiastic you are about the other members of the studio's work. It's great. I think that it fuels excitement with other fans who are kind of following along with Twitter and Facebook and the like to build this interest in seeing the work that they haven't had access to before.
That's excellent.
Well, to get back to you for a second, do you have any other personal projects on the horizon you want to talk about besides Superior Foes? Are you doing any writing, or do you want to do any writing along with art? Like we never really talked about that, but I'm kind of curious where the art and the writing separate, where the passion lies, and where what you might be yearning to do.
I would love to be illustrating my own stories. I like writing. I haven't put myself in a position where I have to do it, and mm-hmm. so I haven't. I'm constantly putting myself into jobs where there are brutal put out fire deadlines, and this has kept me for years from actually writing stories for myself to draw. I've written plenty. I like the process of breaking a story down, and then I always just take on too much work, you know, too much other paying work,
right?
To give myself time to work on something. What I need to do is accept a gig where I'm expected to write and to draw it, so I have no choice but to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, the only published writing of mine out there, there's a Vampirella story I did. I think
is that for Dynamite?
It was for Harris, but it's been reprinted in Vampirella Masters or something like that. A little Googling will turn it up.
Mm.
The story was called The Killing Floor, and that was one of the easiest and smoothest freelance experiences I've ever had. I contacted the editor wanting to know if she was interested in me pitching a story that I would write and draw. She said yes. A couple of days later, I emailed her three ideas for a story, you know, each idea just a couple of sentences. She said, yeah, let's go with the third one. A week later, I sent her the script. I sent it to her at 8 o'clock in the morning. And before lunch, it came back with three edits, all of which I agreed with, very simple mm-hmm. changes. And then 12 days after that, I mailed her 10 pages, penciled, inked, and lettered. And they said, great. And I realized that I probably had the best freelance experience that anyone will ever have.
And now you don't want to yeah. jinx it.
It's all just going to be a trip downhill into misery from there.
Well, do you have any other characters or titles that you would love to draw?
There aren't a lot of examples of other people's characters that I'm really eager to work on. It's never the character that I want to draw. It's, yeah, it's just a really well-crafted story that I'm interested in.
Awesome. Yeah.
That said, there are settings that I like to draw, and some characters are more a part of a setting than others. I love drawing swamps and foliage, and monsters. So a swamp thing story would be a real pleasure to do, and I like the mood that kind of story calls for.
Or man thing.
Yeah, or man thing. I like drawing undersea things. So if there's ever an Aquaman or a Namor story out there that's mostly underwater, I'd be happy to work on that.
You should be pitching Marvel, the Marvel Now, Namor. Number one, Steve Lieber.
Yeah.
In your copious free time.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes, absolutely.
Well, talking about that, so what do you do when you're not drawing? Do you have like a favorite way to unwind or regular routine to kind of help with that work-life balance?
Man, my work-life balance is so out of whack.
That's okay. That is the classic response we've almost gotten from everyone we've interviewed.
Yeah.
It's a business that doesn't just call for workaholics. It basically requires it. You know, when I'm not producing work, I'm publicizing work, or I'm doing organizational stuff for the studio. There's a million things that have to be done to keep Periscope humming along smoothly, and I'm always working on that stuff behind the scenes. I try to get to the gym. I read a lot. Reading is probably the biggest thing. The greatest luxury in the world for me is the chance to sit in a coffee shop with an open novel and just fall into that book for a while.
Well, do you have any favorite comics that you're reading for fun these days? So we asked the listeners to call in to share their deal breaker comic this week. The one that, like, if you introduced it to a close friend or a significant other, if they didn't love it, you'd just be like, sorry, we can't be friends anymore. Do you have an ultimate, like, favorite deal breaker comic that you always will read?
Once upon a time I might have, and there's comics that I'll always read, but there's nothing that I would reject others not read. You know, I think there was a point in my life where if things had broken another way, I could easily have been the sort of terrible schmuck, like the guy in Diner who won't marry his wife unless she can answer a whole lot of sports trivia.
Yeah.
or one of those awful stunted half men in High Fidelity.
Yes, it's inherently judgmental. I completely acknowledge that. But it's also, it's really interesting to hear what, like, emotional response people have to, like, their favorite thing and wanting to share that and share that favorite with another person.
It's fascinating. I mean, like, my favorite stuff, I think my all-time number one cartoonist is Jaime Hernandez from Love and Rockets.
Yeah.
I adore his work. But I remember at art school evangelizing for his stuff, and evangelizing is the only word. I may as well have been walking around with a name tag that said Elder Lieber.
Hey guys, have you heard the good news? It's called Love and Rockets.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of the guys looked at it and just thought, "Yeah, this looks like Archie." madness to me, but nothing is the right book for everyone, and certainly. These days, I think to really appreciate what Jaime's done, you need to start somewhere near, either start somewhere near the beginning, or at least to have that backlog of information about who these characters are, because he trims a lot of the stuff that would make the comic friendly for new readers out. He doesn't reintroduce characters in the way you would if you were doing a weekly TV show and you wanted to constantly increase your viewers.
Right. Well,
go ahead.
Steve, this was awesome. It's so much fun talking with you, and I'm really looking forward to seeing more from the studio at Emerald City Comic Con in March. Do you have any last bits of wisdom that you want to share with us?
Oh gosh. You're asking me for wisdom. Jeez.
I am. I pitched the entire interview based around your ability to share wisdom with the audience.
So don't screw this up, because this is all anybody will remember.
No pressure.
To look for my wisdom in a polished and easily digested state, I would go to the monthly column I write at comic-con.org, the San Diego Comic-Con's website, where I write a monthly column called Dilettante. Which is all about what I've learned in being a cartoonist.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because we'll link to it on the Comics Therapy site, and it's a really fantastic resource. You're a great writer talking about the industry, so I'm I approve of your final bit of wisdom, because that's it's always a great place to get access to more of your wisdom.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, I'm always looking for a chance to be didactic. And
that's like the bit.ly link to all your wisdom.
That's
wonderful.
Right.
Well, thanks again, Steve, for joining us on the couch this week.
Andrew, Aaron, it's been a pleasure.
Well, yeah, it's been a pleasure for us, too. And thank you, everyone else, for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local comic shop or subscribe to them digitally. It's important to ensure the lasting success of the titles we all love. Show notes and other details are on our site, comicstherapy.com. Until next week, talk to you later. Can't you see?